Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 742 of the podcast. And it is Saturday, the 16th of March, 2024, as I record this. In today's show, I have an interview with Claire Taylor about how the Enneagram can help you as an author and how to have a more sustainable author career. Plus, we try to figure out what type I am, which gets pretty personal, to be honest. And Claire talks about how to break through some of the common blocks she sees in the author community. So that's coming up in the interview section. In publishing industry news, well, one of the big things this week is that the House of Representatives in the USA passed a bill to ban TikTok, which is getting a lot of backlash from different parties. But to be clear, it is urging that the company in the US be spun off to US ownership rather than the Chinese ownership, as this is considered a risk to the US national security. So even though there's talk of ban, it's unlikely to disappear, but it might change ownership and the algorithm might also change because of that. So why do I mention this, since we have no control over such a thing? It's instructive to remember that any platform can disappear or change the rules. So once again, don't build your entire author business on one thing. It doesn't matter which platform we are talking about. Anything you don't own can be taken away from you. So if you are doing incredibly well on TikTok and selling lots of books in the USA, then are you also driving people to your email list? If TikTok is eventually banned in your country, or if it's banned in the biggest English-speaking book market in the world, the USA, or if the algorithm changes, or if it changes hands, and yeah, I mean, who knows? Look at what happened when Twitter changed hands. How will your author business be impacted? So again, this has happened many times before, like when Amazon became pay-to-play. Some of us still remember when there was organic reach on these platforms, including Facebook and Instagram also once had organic reach, and all this got throttled. And of course, then when Twitter became X. Platforms change, algorithms change, but what doesn't change? Well, keep writing. Keep writing books, own and control your intellectual property rights, and build your email list. Then you can pivot to use any of the new platforms that emerge, as they inevitably will. And I say this as someone who started self-publishing in the, I guess, the final days of MySpace, which some of you may still remember. Platforms come, platforms go, and TikTok won't be any different. But I know a lot of people are doing really well with it right now. But remember, if you drive people to your email list, then you can just pivot if things change. In the meantime, make the most of it. So Kathleen Schmidt at Publishing Confidential also comments on this. And of course, she has more of a view from the traditional publishing space. This is on Substack. She says, "What will publishers do if BookTok disappears? The industry could be better at planning for things once they happen, and this is the same. What worries me is the industry's reliance on TikTok and other platforms for marketing. Publishers depend on other people's business models, government oversight, and some erratic CEOs to get books in front of consumers. The truth is that no one knows when a social media platform will be sold. Look at what happened to Twitter. Or shut down. Does book publishing have a plan B? I doubt it. And that's a problem." So again, her recommendation is true for authors. Publishing, just read authors, must invest more time and money to make its platforms more interesting. Let's face it, we're not motivated to visit publishers' websites when there are Goodreads, Amazon, and social media. The industry has been happy to allow readers to visit other platforms. This must change. Not because I'm panicking about TikTok, but because it's time for publishers to take full ownership of marketing their books and create communities on their platforms. So yes, lots to think about there. But again, I don't want you to freak. Obviously, I don't even use TikTok, but don't freak out if you're someone who does use it. I would just suggest you make sure that you're ready for any pivot. And as we talked about, this has happened before, this will happen again. But authors who own and control their intellectual property, that means you can license it for sure, but make sure you control it, and also an email list will be fine whatever happens, because we can just pivot. And in terms of ownership and control, indie author megastar Hugh Howie is interviewed this week on the Tim Ferriss podcast by Tim Ferriss. And if you weren't around in the early days of self-publishing, you might not know Hugh Howie. He was one of the early indie authors who went viral with Wool, got a print book deal, and now his series has been adapted, or he's been part of the adaptation, to Apple TV's show Silo. So Hugh is a thoughtful guy, a reader. He often writes about AI as well as the empowerment of self-publishing. So it's good to hear him on Tim's show. A few things from it. Hugh explains how he was working at a bookstore originally when he started writing. He got a small press deal, but later bought the rights back. He said, "Within a year of writing, I was making a couple of $100 a month off my writing, which might sound really small, but puts me in the top 1%. It's insane how little writers make, and I knew that going in because I worked at a bookstore." He talks about cherishing the time when no one knows who you are. He said, "The time that you just get to write because you love to create, you're just trying to write one or two books a year, you're not thinking about sales. That is the best time you'll ever have as a writer. No one's looking over your shoulder. There are no other related demands on your time." He also talks about the importance of owning and controlling your rights. He said, "I've never done a deal where I'm giving away rights for my lifetime, even major deals with publishers," because he does print only with term limits, which means he's not signing any clauses for term of copyright or life of copyright, which is a common clause in publishing contracts. And remember, you know what this means, depending on the jurisdiction, 50 to 70 years after the death of the author. And this is a clause many authors just sign, which means you lose control of your book for basically forever. So they talk, Tim and Hugh talk quite a lot about contracts and also some of the early days of self-publishing. Hugh also says, "I'm dying to self-publish again. I love knowing what's coming in every month, doing price promotions. I love being able to put a new cover on or create new interior content. It's fun to give new life to the editions." So I think that's interesting. They also talk about his writing process. They recommend lots of books, talk about collaboration. And also, he says, the more readers can feel a connection with the person behind the work, the better off your career will be. I'm convinced of that. And of course, I say that regularly here as well. We have to double down on being human and make sure readers know we are people. And just so important. They also discuss AI, the future, religion, having kids, the end of the world, and much more. So have a listen to the Tim Ferriss podcast featuring Hugh Howie on whatever app you're listening to this on. Now, in AI news, I wanted to share an article that Professor Ethan Mollick wrote on his Substack, "I, Cyborg, Using Co-Intelligence, How I Used AI in My Book About AI." Now, Ethan is a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and studies entrepreneurship, innovation and AI. He is one of the most rational commentators on this area. He is not a hype person and he's not a doomer. So I subscribe to his Substack. He has a book coming out, Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI, which I will obviously be reading and talking about. So he says in this article, AI played a critical role in writing the book, though likely not in the ways you might think. I do a lot of writing, and I think I'm a much better writer than any current AI system. All the evidence we have is that the most advanced LLMs write better than most people, but worse than good writers, at least as of March 14th, 2024. The most valuable way to start to use AI for work is to become a centaur or a cyborg, two approaches to co-intelligence that integrate the work of person and machine. Being a centaur depends on a strategic division of labour, switching between AI and human tasks, allocating responsibilities based on the strengths and capabilities of each entity. Cyborgs blend machine and person, integrating the two deeply. Cyborgs don't just delegate tasks, they intertwine their efforts with AI, moving back and forth over the jagged frontier. Bits of tasks get handed to the AI, such as initiating a sentence for the AI to complete, so that cyborgs find themselves working in tandem with the AI. There's lots more in the article. It's always worth reading Ethan Mollick. His site is oneusefulthing.org. I'll link to it in the show notes, but this absolutely explains how I collaborate with both ChatGPT and Claude, this cyborg approach of intertwining tasks, sparking off things, circling away to write on my own, circling back, sparking some more. I also like this term jagged frontier. There is no straight line between what, you know, human and AI. It's this intertwining jaggedness. And of course, AI tools are better than me at many, many things. Coding would be one example, and a lot worse at others. So I really like this. I think you definitely well worth reading. Now, also in terms of using AI as part of the writing process, you might remember the Japanese author who recently won a prestigious literary prize in Japan while openly using ChatGPT. Links in the show notes. Well, now it's also the Pulitzer Prize, as reported on Editor and Publisher. It says, 5 of the 45 finalists in this year's Pulitzer Prize for Journalism disclosed using AI in the process of researching, reporting, or telling their submissions. It's the first time the awards, which received around 1,200 submissions this year, required entrants to disclose AI usage. The Pulitzer Board only added this requirement to the journalism category. So I think this is brilliant because we need to be open about our usage, as I have always been. And if prize-winning fiction and Pulitzer, potentially Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists are disclosing usage, what is the problem? So more evidence that the use of AI tools are just going to become part of our creative and business processes over time. In personal news, well, it's been a very busy 10 days with a pretty exciting announcement at the end. So I was in the south of Spain for 20 Books Seville, and I did a keynote on AI. I attended some other sessions and I had meetings and did lots of networking and drinking wine and eating jamón, as well as meeting authors in the community. Michael Anderley opened the conference with one clear message saying, "There are no rules. No one can tell you how to write your books or run your author business. Part of being an independent author is deciding which path to take in this increasingly splintered landscape. But of course, don't try to do it all, but do find out what others are doing and ask them, but only after doing your homework." And this has been getting to me recently, because as I keep talking about, this is a great splintering. We are not all doing the same thing anymore. And so you need to check what authors are doing before you ask them. So I've recently been getting questions like, "How do you use Substack?" "I don't use Substack." Or, "What are your tips for TikTok?" I think I've been pretty clear that I don't use TikTok. Or, "How do I sell more books on Amazon?" Which, to be honest, I barely even look at these days because I focus on selling direct. So yeah, definitely, if you have questions about various ways to publish or market, find the authors who are actually using the things you are interested in. On TikTok, author Adam Beswick does very well on the platform and did a great session at 20 Books Seville. He advised making content that was more human, with less polished production, making videos of between 6 to 14 seconds and posting it multiple times, and making sure to have your sales on the back end sorted. And he does direct sales, amongst other things. The authors making serious bank on TikTok are selling direct. And of course, selling direct does spill into sales on other platforms. But actually, most of Adam's session was on the mindset of that he and a shift he's gone through in the last year. And I will be having him on the show at some point over the next few months to talk about that. I also talked to a lot of authors about money and business, thanks to those who got into conversation with me about investing and various other things. I also talked about the changes in my own business model. Based on many of those discussions, I have decided You're going to laugh. I'm going to do an updated edition of Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur. Now, I know I said I'm not going to do any new books for Joanna Penn, but Business for Authors is a decade old. Can you believe it? I first published that in 2014. It sold hardly any copies. That's probably because a decade ago, most people didn't want to run a business. So, and of course, How to Make a Living with Your Writing was a slightly different angle on that. And that sells really, really well. But Business for Authors, I really feel like it's important to talk about. And because after Spear of Destiny, my next kind of big book will be Gothic Cathedrals, which will be in 2025. I think I could do an updated edition of Business for Authors in the, I don't know, third quarter of 2024. So we shall see. I think I could do that alongside my research for Gothic Cathedrals. I think it's really needed because some of the stuff we were talking about, I was like, and someone said to me, oh, but I read your Business for Authors and you didn't mention that. And I was like, oh, okay, that book is old. I need to update it. So back on Seville, unfortunately, it was cold and raining and I got sick again. I have been sick too much in the last month, possibly working too hard, possibly doing too many things. But yes, so I've been sick again. I was only able to get to London Book Fair for one day, fueled by medication and cough sweets. I chaired a panel on the rise and rise of indie authors with Orna Ross and Michael Laron. I had some meetings with key vendors and, most excitingly, and the reason I went in, I was up for an award, the Selfies Award for the Best Nonfiction Memoir, which I won. And yes, I'm now an award-winning author. The award was presented that day. I didn't know I was going to win. I was very nervous. If you've been listening a long time, you'll know how much I've wanted to be an award-winning author. You can find the book on all the various platforms and the special edition hardback is on my store. All the editions are linked at jfpenn.com/pilgrimage. Now, indie authors get most of their validation from reader reviews and emails, as well as sales and money in the bank account. But I have always wanted award validation, and I think many of you do too. So I have won awards. I've won awards for being a creative entrepreneur. I've won several for this podcast, and I was a finalist for the Best Ebook Original in 2017 for the International Thriller Writers for Destroyer of Worlds. But I didn't win. I was sitting next to James Scott Bell, the lovely James Scott Bell that year, who writes legal thrillers and all kinds of books. And Jim won that year. But now I do have an award-winning book as JF Penn. The judging was around the content of the book, the quality of the production, thanks to Book Vault, and the marketing campaign proving success. So thanks to everyone who backed the Kickstarter, as that gave me ample evidence of sales. So on my fiction, I'm still writing the first draft of Spear of Destiny. As a discovery writer, I often get to this point where I feel like I've lost the plot in some way. So I have printed out 45,000 words of what I have so far. I'm working my way through the scenes, noting down open story questions and character arcs I need to flesh out. I'm still a little unclear on the ending. I kind of know, but there's a few things I don't know, but I do know it will happen under the Capitol in Washington, D.C. So the Kickstarter pre-launch page is up. If you are interested, jfpenn.com/destiny. Also, if you want to hear me interviewed, I'm on the Casual Author podcast, talking about tips for entrepreneurially minded authors, and it's aimed at authors who are not full-time. I had a great conversation with Dan, the host. If you enjoyed The Relaxed Author Approach, the book I did with Mark Lefebvre, you will enjoy this. I'm also on Patrick O'Donnell's Cops and Writers Show, talking about curiosity, the shadow, trigger warnings, giving away the farm and more. So that's Cops and Writers. Also, I wanted to mention friend of the show and fantastic writer and podcaster Rachel Herron has her Kickstarter pre-launch page up for Unstuck. Links in the show notes, or just go to kickstarter.com and search for probably Unstuck will get you there. But yes, Rachel is fantastic, and I'm sure many of you listen to her show too. And her show is Ink in Your Veins. Right, so thanks for all your emails and comments and photos this week. Thanks for the many, many congratulation comments on my award win on the various social media platforms. And in terms of comments, Joanna McKethan says on YouTube on Becca Symes' interview, two of my favourites together. It's great to find my tribe. Fantastic. And Brian said, sent a lovely picture. He said, I drive a box truck or lorry, as you Brits call it. It gives me plenty of time to learn more about becoming an author. I really appreciate how easy your books are to understand and read and the positive attitude you have in your podcast and books. And he sent a picture from the truck with how to write a novel. Thank you, Brian. I really love to see that. And hello, if you're listening in your truck or lorry. So please leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel at The Creative Pen, or email me, send me pictures of where you're listening, joanna@thecreativepen.com. I love to hear from you. It makes this more of a conversation. So this episode is sponsored by Draft2Digital, providing self-publishing with support. And this is one of the great reasons you might choose to publish through Draft2Digital. They have a wonderful customer service team who can help you, and sometimes that's just what you need. You can publish ebooks to all the platforms, all the big platforms, as well as library systems. You can also publish print books, and they can help you through that process too. They have free formatting tools as well as an easy publishing system. I use Draft2Digital for my ebook distribution to Nook, library systems, and now even to Apple, because as part of being a sustainable author, as we talk about in today's show, I just do not have the time to keep updating all the wide platforms. I also use their excellent payment splitting for my co-written book, The Relaxed Author, with Mark Leslie Lefebvre, a great option if you're co-writing or working with a group of authors on a collaboration, as they do the payments, which is a real overhead if you do it manually. There are no charges for formatting or updating your book. Draft2Digital take a distributor 10% of retail price on sale. No upsells, no service packages, no fees of any kind. Set your price to whatever you want, even free. Make as many changes as you want to your book, update the cover, distribute it to any and every sales channel you want. It's your book, your choice, and your world. They also have marketing tools and promotional opportunities available. Draft2Digital says, your book is your priority. Our priority is you. We build tools and services that let you focus on writing while we take care of layout, publishing, distribution, print-on-demand paperbacks, and more. Check them out at draft2digital.com. That's draft2digital.com. So this type of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my community at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thanks to the 14 new patrons who've joined since I recorded the last show. Thanks to everyone who's been supporting for months and years. Last week, I shared a video demo of the new model Claude 3 for both fiction and non-fiction, around half an hour of me sharing my prompts and responses for how to use Claude 3 Opus model for aspects of creativity as well as marketing. If you join the community, you get access to that and all the backlist videos and audio, as well as access to the monthly Q&A where you can ask your questions, essentially an extra solo episode a month. The Patreon is a monthly subscription, the equivalent of a black coffee a month or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous. So if you get value from this show and you want more, come on over and join more than 1,000 authors. And thanks to everyone who's been supporting the show for ages. You're amazing. I'm so glad you find the show useful after all this time. Join us at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Claire Taylor writes comedy fiction, science fiction, paranormal cozy mystery, and serial killer crime, with more than 40 books under various pen names. She also teaches authors through courses, consulting, and her books for writers, which include Reclaim Your Author Career and the new book Sustain Your Author Career. So welcome to the show, Claire.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh no, it's lots to talk about today. But first up, just tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing and publishing.
Well, I was one of those people who wanted to be a writer since I was like 10 years old. And then I had just years of people telling me that was unrealistic. That was fun. Luckily, I'm a little bit bullheaded. And so I decided I was going to keep writing anyway and studied it in college. All of my professors basically frowned upon the kind of writing that I wanted to do. And so I was trying to figure out, well, how am I going to do this anyway? And then I joined a critique group after college, and that's where I met Alyssa Archer, who introduced me to all of the options that are included in publishing independently. And I knew immediately that's what I wanted to do. So I skipped all the querying and just started learning the skills of self-publishing. And it's basically just been from there. I like being a one-woman show, being able to call the shots. So I kind of never looked back once I went indie.
Just give people a date then. So when did you start self-publishing?
Well, I did like a semi self-publishing thing, sort of one of those hybrid borderline ripoff kind of things in like 2012. And then in 2014, I started publishing my own stuff through KDP.
So you mentioned they were a bit bullheaded and like to be in control. I've been wondering about this because I feel like I'm similar. And do you think that there is a personality type who does well as an indie author, or can anyone be successful in this industry?
I think anyone can find something that really resonates with them in this industry. I think as far as the perspective I come from with all of my training, every personality type, every quality, every positive, healthy quality we have can be overdone and work against us. So it's really about sort of finding out the way that you want to go about this indie publishing business and making sure that you're not overdoing it.
Yeah, I do wonder though, because I get people email me now and they say, oh, it seems a lot of work. And I'm like, yeah, it's work to do this career. And if you don't want to do the work of publishing, then you need a publisher, like a traditional publisher. Right.
Yes. So I would say that if you don't want to do work, this is probably not the path for you. If you don't want to do a whole lot of work, maybe just publish it as a blog or something like that. But I mean, I love a good challenge. And so I love teaching myself new skills. I find that very engaging. And so I think that is probably a necessary thing. But also, I think it's not just the person. I think it's the time of life where you're approaching this, because maybe you were a person who had a lot of energy to do this, and that might have been the right time. And now you just, the situation of your life, you're like, I just don't care to do this much work anymore. And then maybe it's time to switch.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so you're well known in the author community for your work around the Enneagram and how that helps writers. So for anyone who doesn't know, can you just outline what the Enneagram is and how it does help?
Yeah, of course. So the Enneagram, it's a personality system that describes 9 core fears and desires. So we classify those as types, or sometimes a lens. Sometimes we call it an Enneagram style. But each type is defined by what it fears and desires most. And so those fears are very deep things, like being bad or corrupt or lacking value or being trapped in deprivation. They're not like a fear of snakes, that sort of thing. So what arises from our core fear are these patterns of thinking, feeling, and doing that we can get very, very stuck in. So it's like having these blinders on before we start doing this work. And so those blinders really limit our options. And in our industry, we have a crisis of people being stuck and trapped because they've limited their options. Their subconscious mind has limited their options because of the patterns that it's functioning in as a default. So they can't always see an aligned path forward when the industry undergoes swift changes, which it does very frequently. So I can give you an example. Mm-hmm. If you're an author who's what we call a type 3, this is the achiever, then your core fear is lacking value or being worthless. And pretty much everything you do is to avoid confronting this fear or feeling like you lack value or are worthless if you're a 3. So a pattern that almost always arises from this is the belief that they earn value through accomplishments and achievements. So this can look like how many books they have in their catalog, how high their books rank after launch, and how many subscribers they have on their email list. So it all seems well and good to attach your sense of worth to those things when they're going well for you. But everyone who's been in this industry for a little while sees that all of those numeric indicators are becoming more difficult to come by. And the result is that we have a bunch of Enneagram 3 authors whose self-worth is being eroded because they've attached it to something fleeting. So they may be trapped in that pattern and they may not see another way of being because it's kind of the water they swim in. So the Enneagram is a roadmap for many, many other ways of being and how we can be the healthiest and most sustainable version of ourselves.
Yeah, I like the idea of the lens because I think that's important. And obviously, we both friends with Becca Simon, the kind of Clifton strength side of things. I also like the Myers-Briggs. All of these do different elements of personality and they can all help in different ways. And so yes. It's funny because people did recommend to me your work in the Enneagram and I didn't go anywhere near it. I was like, oh yeah, no, I just don't have time to look at this. And then when we arranged this interview, I'm like, okay, I need to read your books. So I've read both of these books now. And so and we're going to do a bit of diagnosis for the listeners. I'm going to get some free consulting on the show. So basically, I was reading it and I, like you mentioned there, this achiever, the type 3. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. I just work really hard. I'm goal orientated. But some of the things you said weren't necessarily true, but I do, you know, I do have on my wall, measure your life by what you create. So I really am quite fixated on creating things and work is my worth. And I definitely am questioning this in the age of AI, you know, if a machine can generate stuff, what does that make me? So I'm definitely going through that. But then our mutual friend, Becca Syme, said she thinks I'm a 5, which is more about curiosity. And I was like, oh my goodness, that's totally me too. So I'm sure this will happen to other people. Like if they read your book and they'll be like, oh, but that's me and that's me and that's me. So how do we work out what Enneagram type we are? And maybe we can work out what I am.
Okay. Yes, definitely. So it is a thing that a lot of people run into because we often haven't thought of ourselves and sorted it into these sort of terms before. So it can take a little bit of time and there's value in that discovery process. But if you're going between a couple and you're like, I don't know if I'm this or this, they both seem really common, then there are some differentiating questions that we can refer to. And so it's kind of like, okay, if you answer more this way, then you're probably going to want to read a little bit more about this type versus if you answer a little more this way. So it's very useful. There's a process for this. You can also take a test online, but the tests aren't super accurate, with the exception of the IEQ-9, which is one that I can administer and work with you on. But that one's about 95% accurate on type and subtype. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to take a test. So you can read about it. So if you're looking between a 3 and a 5, there's going to be some major differences and a lot of overlap. And this is why we want to look at, always go back to those core motivations rather than the behaviors. Because if you're looking at someone who's like a real high achiever, they're not necessarily an achiever. They could be. But maybe they're a high achiever because they actually think that good people are hard workers and they want to be a good person, in which case they're probably an Enneagram 1, right? So we want to make sure that we're not looking too much at behavior. But if you're ready, I can ask you some differentiating questions.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you find, is your sense of competence more about the results of your efforts and what you can achieve or more about what you know?
Ooh, this is hard because I turn everything I know into a book. So it's like I love research. Like I am so deep in research right now for my next novel, Spear of Destiny. I've read like all these books on the Nazis and the occult and all this. But I consider it the way to turn my curiosity into, so the process is why I do it. This is why I love it. But then I need to turn it into something in order to say, like, the process is finished. So that's right down the middle.
That's pretty close down the middle. Do you use the books as an excuse to validate what you want to learn about?
I think it's the other way around.
Okay.
In that I will learn about stuff. For example, I'll go to a place, like I went to Amsterdam one time and I was like, had an amazing time, went to all these cool places, found out all this stuff and then said, I need to write a book about it. So it's the curiosity definitely comes first and I need to use that to drive the outcome because I think then it gives me an excuse to spend more time on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me go to the next question. So the 5 is in the thinking triad. The 3 is in the heart triad. So that's the emotions.
Oh, I'm thinking. So, I definitely. Oh.
Okay. All right. So, but the 3 doesn't look a whole lot like a feeling type because it's what's called the contradicted type of the triad. So 3s can put their feelings aside to get things done, but they can also kind of access those feelings from time to time. Now, the 5 is much more in their head and probably early in life. And as you're getting older, maybe now you've done a lot of work, but the feelings are a little harder to access for the 5. The 5s tend to tell you what they think when you ask them how they feel. So,
oh yeah, that's totally me. That's okay. So me. And do you know what's so funny with AI? A lot of the stuff I do now with AI is I'll be like, can you help me make this more emotional? Because my writing is...
computer.
Help me be more emotional because it's all thinking kind of stuff. Okay, so I generally trust whatever Becca says, right? So I was like, oh, okay, maybe I'm fine. So yeah, so I'm definitely more of a thinking type, but I feel like...
No, I love the honesty.
I'm just being honest, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I would say that you might want to look at the 5. And now the 5 can be very productive. As an investigator, it can be this sort of high achieving type. And that's a pretty healthy 5. So sometimes 5s get stuck in the thinking realm and they don't remember to necessarily use that knowledge that they've gained. So they gain a bunch of knowledge for this sort of sense of security of like, okay, I know how to do the things. I'm capable. I'm competent. That's the core desire of the 5. But as the 5 has these healthy expressions, it starts to take on some of the qualities of the type 8, which is the challenger. And so that's more of the doing energy. That is, the challengers are in the body or gut triad. So that's the action triad. They are going out and doing things. So the 5 tends to actually use that knowledge and expertise.
Okay, and so well, that sounds yeah. good. I'm going to read more about that. But then I guess we have to be very clear that there's some dark sides. You mentioned fear and I guess desires, and these things can be not so healthy. So just give it to me. Like, what are the unhealthy sides of a 5 that I might be struggling with?
Okay, yes. So Don Richard Rizzo and Russ Hudson have this measurement. They call it the levels of development for each type. So each of the 9 types has 9 levels of development. 3 are healthy, 3 are average, and 3 are unhealthy. So it's kind of the sliding scale. Now, the healthiest level is called liberation, and people like to learn about what their liberation looks like. That's when we've integrated the truth. We already feel like we are the thing we've been seeking. So our core fear feels unimportant, and our core desire feels fulfilled. No one spends that much time in liberation, so nobody freak out. But that's the part that we like to learn about because it's like, oh, look, it's our higher self. And we spend most of our time at the average levels. So that's where we kind of get in our own way about some things. And we're not necessarily living for a higher ideal, but the things that we're doing aren't immediately harmful. And then we get down into those unhealthy levels and things get very dicey. So the unhealthy levels are the ones that people tend to create these boundaries around of like, that's not me and that will never be me. And so when we do the shadow work, we want to accept that that could be you. And in accepting that, we really lessen the likelihood that it will be you. Mm. So these unhealthy levels, it's where we start to not just kind of get in our own way, but we start to create harm. We harm ourselves and others, and we don't have the tools of self-awareness to actually get out of them sometimes. So we can get trapped in these lower levels, and that's where we spiral. So for a 5, this can look a little bit like hoarding. This can be kind of that security gets a little, the need for security and the need for gathering resources can get a little
I'm laughing because you can't see, we're not on video, you can't see my office. I have so many books. We have a rule between my husband and I that when spending money on books doesn't count. So I mentioned the research for Spear of Destiny. I mean, I kid you not, I have so many books. And what I also do is I do hoard books for future projects, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are hardbacks, a lot of them are expensive, beautiful books, and I literally pile them up around me. Here in my office right now, I am surrounded by piles and piles of books that contain knowledge that I need to learn to turn into books. So I think the word hoarding made me laugh, because I think books are an acceptable form of hoarding for writers, I suppose.
Yeah, you're absolutely welcome to tell yourself that.
So maybe some people listening are like, okay, hoarding is an interesting word, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And so it's sort of fortifying this fortress of knowledge to keep ourselves safe. That's what can happen with the five. And that's a pretty average five. Most fives I know have an extensive library, especially author fives. I mean, it's the rule of about, it doesn't count if you're buying books. You can just buy as many books as you want. Very common. You know?
Okay, that's good. I feel better. But I guess I'm thinking, I know sometimes, I'll admit it, I can be a bit of a know-it-all. And is that okay. Like a bad side of it? And I try not to be, but sometimes I'm like, you know, I want to prove that I know all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's a pretty average expression
of
a five. Yeah, yeah. No, the average expressions, they're kind of things that we're like, yeah, I know that about myself, and I try not to, but it just kind of happens. And there are things that people may note about us, but may not be like deal breakers for friendship and that sort of thing. Mm.
What else is in the shadow?
Yes. So the five tends to go into, I have to know things other people don't. And so the dark side of five can be almost trollish behavior. So sometimes the five will, because they've become so detached from their own heart center, they will try to needle people to get the other person emotional, almost like to torment them. So that can be the trolling, right? This is very dark stuff. It can be if someone says, is giving some heartfelt thing online and they use the wrong version of your, right? The response just being the like asterisk and then the correct spelling of your. That would be a way, sort of an unhealthy behavior of a five.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely don't do that, mainly because I'm not on social media.
Yeah.
But no, I do feel myself in my head sometimes. I might think things like that. So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And so, and it can kind of become this, the five moves towards isolation, because the five can feel like, okay, I have this limited amount of energy, right? And if I let too many people in, they're going to just completely drain me of all of this energy. And so that sort of awareness of the battery of the five can lead to the five building a lot of obstacles between them and the outside world, so that the outside world can't encroach on their energy.
Mm. And I put that down to being an introvert. Do you think that's like a double whammy?
I think it might be a double whammy. I think that might be a multiplier. Mm. But because, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're going to have the boundaries, but the five is really aware of it. And so that can turn into that isolation. And over time, the five can build a fortress around them if they're unhealthy. And the stereotype would be like the person living in their mother's basement on the computer all the time, right? Which I don't think you're in jeopardy of becoming, but there's probably a part of you that can kind of relate to that isolation, right?
Might be happier in the basement. Not at my mom's, though, I must say. But I mean, obviously people listening might not be a five. So we should just say that in both the books, right, in Reclaim Your Career and Sustain Your Author Career, you talk about these types in both of the books.
Yes, yes. So I talk a lot more about defining them in Reclaim Your Author Career. I do have a section on it in Sustain Your Author Career. But it's okay if you're coming into Sustain Your Author Career and you're not 100% sure of your type. There's still something that you can get out of it. Thankfully, we can read books more than once. And so you can read it saying, well, what if I'm a four? And over the course of reading it, there may be information there that I describe about the four that you're like, I just don't think this is it. And that's okay, right? So this discovery process can take a really long time for some people. It doesn't have to. If you're getting frustrated and like, I just want to know my type, you can come talk to me and I can help you get there. But yeah, so I do talk about the types, and there's a lot of information throughout the book of, you know, this is what resilience might look like for each type. This is the problems that you're going to run into for each type. And I have these concepts in action where after I discuss a concept, I'll give an example of someone I was working with, very, very well disguised. Don't worry, guys. I keep your identity safe, but examples of a specific type dealing with that issue. So you can see, oh, is that kind of like me? Is that not like me? So there's a lot of, is this like me? Is this not like me that you can do with the book.
Well, just being practical then about how people turn this knowledge into, I guess, useful information. I mean, like in Sustain Your Author Career, you do have these types of blocks that authors might face. Maybe you could outline some of the most common blocks that you see and what authors can do about those, because I guess they're also related to the types.
Yeah. Definitely. So there are a few blocks that authors face, regardless of their type, that I keep seeing come up again and again in my coaching. So one is that they need to build more rest into their daily routine. And so no one really taught us what rest looks like, which means our idea is kind of this monolithic, like laying on the couch and watching TV. And that's almost never restful. That's almost never the kind of rest that you need. So I try and expand our idea of what rest looks like in the book. It's really about getting into different patterns and figuring out, is it my head, my heart, or my body that's tired? And that can really lead us to some new interesting ways of resting and refreshing in small amounts on a daily basis so that we don't have to take a month off to get over burnout. And now another block that I see coming up a lot is the need for certainty. And so people get a little bit confused around certainty because oftentimes they're waiting to have certainty in the outcome before they take the action. And so we can never have certainty in an outcome. So sometimes the information we need can only be found by taking the action, by running the experiment, by testing the ads, right? We can't learn everything ahead of time and then be like, okay, then this is guaranteed to succeed, right? There's some action that needs to be involved before we start to have not certainty, but confidence that we can figure it out. So that shift from certainty to sort of a self-assurance is a block that is a way to get past the block. But as far as like an Enneagram specific block, one that I include is this over-labeling that we tend to do. So yeah. Each type tends to attach two particular labels to everything. So this is a subconscious pattern and we're just not aware that we're doing it most of the time. So our subconscious filters things for us. And then if it passes the subconscious filter, our conscious mind might become aware of it. So you may not know that this is happening, but a lot of the times when I'm interviewing people and working with people, I can hear these labels come through in their language. For example, if you are an Enneagram 1, which is the reformer, this is a person who's concerned about being a good person and doing everything right. So they start to slap on labels of right and wrong to everything. They're over-labeling things as this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. It can even be right in sort of a ethical sense, wrong in an ethical sense. Their subconscious is painting with this really broad brush too. So the reformer ends up ruling out a lot of potentially useful options for their career without even recognizing it. So if they go, oh, this is wrong, so I'm not going to do this. This kind of thing is wrong, right? This can be, a lot of the times there's this sort of knee-jerk ick with the ones when it comes to marketing and marketing options. And so we want to dive in and just hold these things up and say, is this actually wrong? Or is there a way that you could do it that felt good to you, right? So we stop painting with the broad brush. Now, for like a 3, the labels are success and failure. For the 7, the labels are pleasurable or painful. And so each type has these labels to look through and say, where am I attaching things and or attaching these labels to things where they just frankly don't belong?
Oh, so, you have to say the 5 now.
The 5 is wise and foolish.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And foolish not being the word, stupid would be the word.
right. Yep.
Okay, no, yeah. That makes
sense. Would a smart person do this or would a dumb person do this? That's kind of the the labels. Oh,
yeah, it's so funny, isn't it? Labeling. That's a difficult problem when you label something, as you say, almost without knowing that you're labeling it, but then you recognize it later. So, yeah, I think both your books definitely have this sort of insight that's fascinating. Is it easier to see these things in other people than it is in yourself?
Oh, absolutely.
Wait, you have to tell us what you are.
I am a one, so I am the reformer. I was overlabeling things as right and wrong too much, and it really narrowed my options. And I mean, I think that's why this is like the biggest secret weapon of the book, this overlabeling, because I was doing that so much. And then when I realized that, like, oh, gee, Claire, maybe there's not a morally right or wrong way to do most things in this business, it was like the clouds parted and the angels were singing down to me like, oh, you have options. Congratulations, you know. So, yeah, there's plenty of things that they just are perfectly reasonable options and they don't conflict with my morals. But because I had experienced this sort of ick around them, and ones really have this gut sense of like, I don't like that. So I had experienced that and written off a bunch of stuff. And now kind of going back and being like, well, is there a way that I can do this that is perfectly fine and works morally and ethically for me? And the answer is almost always yes.
No, that's good to know. So coming to this, because I think the labeling might help in Reclaim Your Author Career, you say, as the indie publishing industry matures, the cracks begin to show. And I was like, oh, yes, that's totally it. And I've talked about the splintering of business models and also the splintering of the community. Now, it's happened many times since I started here in like 2007 when I started self-publishing. And I mean, there's been a lot of splintering, but now I like your phrase, the cracks begin to show. But so what do you mean by that? And how can authors navigate these changes and this need for certainty, I guess?
I certainly agree with your assessment of the cracks that are showing. But on top of that, from what I do in my perspective, I think we've had really unreasonable expectations of this career as a collective. And so those expectations are very slow to catch up to the reality. And so some of the beliefs that were proliferated were just out of touch and really played on the desperation of a bunch of people trying to make writing work as a profession, right? There's just this hope and this desperation to get there. And these ideas were sort of these false promises that we saw some examples of happening. Like, oh yeah, there's a few people who did these things and followed these ideas and had this success that's sort of the nebulous dream of being an indie author. So like the idea that there was a silver bullet, right? If you just start doing Amazon ads, your books will take off, or TikTok, that's it. That's your ticket to the big time, right? These silver bullets, we're starting to see, I think, more collectively that they don't exist. There's also that belief that if you do X tactic, then Y sales are guaranteed. And if it didn't work that way, that was because you didn't do something right. So those beliefs weren't really built on any solid foundation. And now I think the cracks are showing with them. I think we're starting to see that they aren't true, and they probably never were true. But we're seeing people burn out as a result of that. People's frustration with their own lack of sales, it's morphing into these pylons and these moral panics in the industry. And so much of that intensity can be calmed simply by turning our attention to the basics of what we can and can't control. So you can control what you do, and you can't control the results of it, including how other people feel about what you do. And it's a very basic concept, but I think we kind of got outside of that wisdom when we started thinking that certain actions in this industry would lead to certain results, and that if it didn't happen, something was just not right about it, rather than the assumption was faulty. So I think that a lot of that basic wisdom was being drowned out by the sort of 6-7-figure author razzle dazzle. Like, if there's a way to guarantee that your formula resulted in authors making 6 figures a year, then every author would be making 6 figures a year. So I just think as an industry, promises, the expectations that were these givens or these accepted beliefs by and large are just being proven false. And we're seeing the fallout of it through the negative emotions that are resulting from it. And so those cracks are starting to show in those beliefs. And the people who are going to stay on and stay in this game are the ones who are adjusting to the reality.
Mm. Yeah, I was just thinking then that the Japanese art of kintsugi, where they fix broken pottery with gold and silver. And I would love that to be our community. I feel quite sad having attracted quite a lot of negativity myself and some other people in the community. And I wish we would like just this healthy, happy, creative community. Is that just is that just unrealistic? I mean, how can we mend these cracks and make it something beautiful?
Well, I think that might be an unrealistic goal, but I think it's a perfectly fine purpose.
Okay. Maybe I should just hang on to that.
A purpose is just something we move toward each day. And it's something that we, you know, it's this ideal and we don't get frustrated when we're not there, but we can commit ourselves to making it a little bit more like that. And that, I think if enough people are doing that, then we can make progress and we can at least create a space where the people who do want to be part of that sort of vibrant, nurturing community have a place to come. And then the people who don't want to be a part of that can go be disgruntled elsewhere. But yeah, I really think that the upheaval of our industry, which this industry is kind of one upheaval after another, which is just kind of ride the waves, learn to surf, but it's an opportunity for us to really get serious and look at ourselves and build the sustainable author who then will build a sustainable author career. So I think that metaphor you used of the gold filling in the cracks, that really is like we have an opportunity to fill in these cracks of not just our author career, but who we are as humans and to heal these parts of ourselves that have been sort of thrown into the light in this environment. And that's really, I think, what keeps me going, even though I know that especially some of the stuff in my new book is a little bit iconoclastic. So I know I'll get some heat, but for every person who is mad at me, there's a lot of people who are falling back in love with their writing, connecting with it again, letting it nourish them after this work, and watching the benefits of it expand into their life as a whole. And that's really just, I mean, that seems like it's worth the time for me.
Well, it's interesting because I referenced your book in my book, Writing the Shadow, because so many people said it was a good way to look into the shadow work. And I felt when I put that book out, oh my goodness, I'm going to get some response to this. But it's interesting. I think the same with your books is the people who read these types of books are looking to do the deeper work around their personality and their lifestyle and build resilience and all that kind of thing. And I don't think they're the ones who react so negatively. So it's been a positive response to Writing the Shadow. Like the people who do read it think about it, even if it does trigger them in some way, as your book certainly could as well. So I want to encourage you there.
Yeah, I've been very lucky to have most of the people who have a strong reaction just kind of show themselves out. And then
they're not talking to you anymore, they're not buying your books, but they've just left the building, basically.
They've left the building, they keep their trash talk to back channels that I never see, and that's blissful for me. But the result of what I do is that, I was just thinking about this recently, it's so amazing when we do this work, when we ask people to like look at themselves honestly and share honestly and be this like authentic version of themselves. And when we show them that that is okay, all of the parts of them are okay, then like I've ended up surrounded by these amazing human beings where I'm like, wow, you know, people come to being an author after a lot of the times after they've lived these full lives doing completely different things. And then you get to meet them and you're just like, wait, you did what? And they're just so insightful and wise. And it's just, it's really amazing. So it does make me nervous. I would be lying if I didn't say that I get a little anxiety every time I publish something. But man, it's added so much to my life, being able to meet so many people.
Yeah, it's worth doing for sure. So you've mentioned resilience a few times. And I guess I've always talked about the long-term game and always thought, ahead. I'm a sort of a futurist type person, so I've always mentioned that. But I've definitely always been fascinated by authors who are still publishing decades after they started because they have something and they've surfed all the changes and all of that. And so how can authors build resilience in order to sustain their author career for the long term?
Well, I think the biggest tool for resilience is recognizing that we're already resilient, that we've already done the hard things. We tend to dismiss the challenges that we've overcome almost as soon as we overcome them. Like, well, if I could do it, then obviously it wasn't that hard, right? But I think really taking a moment to look back can help us recognize that we have tools that we haven't been naming. So naming those tools can be really useful because we tend to carry around a lot of anxiety about like, oh, what if the worst happens? Will I be able to handle it? If my book flops, if it's panned, like what will I do? How will I be able to live with myself? So it can be really helpful to remember that we've already had bad things happen to us and we've found a way forward. Maybe the exact details are different, but if you found a way before, you will find it again. Like there's more evidence for your resilience than there is against it. So on top of that trick, which can be eye-opening in itself, each Enneagram type has this force inside of them that they can fall back on. So for example, sixes have a huge amount of courage and the sense of duty to the group. And that can light them up if given enough space, right? They get knocked down. Why do they get back up? Because they have this sense of duty to the group. They have the most fear of any type, sixes. But because of that, they have the most, they've built their muscle of courage the most because they know how to act in spite of the fear. And so nines have this, they're urged on by this sense of harmony and they have this gift of perspective. And these are healing forces that we have, but they're also really subtle. So learning what they are and how to spot them, that's what gives us a leg up and the confidence that they'll be there when we need them. So it's always okay to lick your wounds a little bit, right? You know, you have a book that fails, get up from the computer, go do whatever you want to get your mind off it, talk to your friends, rage, cry a little, whatever works for you. Go lick your wounds. That's fine. But the healing process requires a little bit of space to get started. And these forces that we have that get us back up are a little bit quiet. So knowing what they are and how to name them and, you know, how to recognize them, we can take heart in knowing that they will show up for us. And as long as we don't fall irreversibly into self-pity, we'll be fine.
Eventually, yeah. So as this goes out, you have a Kickstarter for Sustain Your Author Career. So tell people what they can find in the book and in the campaign, and hopefully they'll come over and have a look.
Yeah, so the Kickstarter runs through March 29th, and that includes the book in its various forms. You can also pick up Reclaim Your Author Career through there if you haven't done that yet. And then I'm offering all of my author services through there at a discounted rate or the regular rate, but you get a book with it, right? So you can sign up. Some of the stuff is limited seating. So the first place you can get it is through Kickstarter. That includes any coaching. I have some workshops in there. I have a book club with reflection questions. I have my Liberated Writer course is offered through there. That's a 5-week course. And my Liberated Writer retreat, which is in October. All of that you can get through there. So it's basically, you look at the book, you say, okay, how much support do I need? Because we are very independent people, by and large, indie authors. And we sometimes overlook the step of finding the support we need. We can do anything if we have the support we need for it. So just kind of understanding like, okay, I'm new to this. I don't have a whole lot of help at home or my energy is limited. A lot of people I work with are dealing with chronic illness. How much support do you need? And then you can look at the tiers and find what makes sense for you. Mm. And that's how I've designed it.
Fantastic. So where else can people find you and your books and everything you do online?
Well, so I should say the Kickstarter, if you go to kickffs.com, you will go to the Kickstarter, and then everything else from me can be found at ffs.media. That's all of my other offerings and books, including Brilliant. My fiction.
Yes, your fiction. We didn't even talk about that, but you have lots of quite unusual types of books. So definitely yes. People should have a look at that. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Claire. That was great.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So we hope you found this discussion with Claire interesting and that you can figure out the right ways to sustain your author career. So let me know what you think of today's show. Please leave a comment on the show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel, or you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Next week, I'm talking about tips for selling and marketing direct using Meta Ads with Matthew J. Holmes, who's been running my direct to Shopify ads for almost 6 months now. So we have lots of insights to talk about. That's coming up next week. And in the meantime, happy writing. and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.